Our fourth case for this morning is Richardson against the Koch Law Firm. Directly from you, Mr. Richardson.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. Opposing counsel. We are here on a case that was dismissed from the local court based on a Rockefeller-Feldman doctrine. Since the dismissal of the case, which is also spoken to in our brief, the bankruptcy court actually has gone ahead and ruled that the state court order was entered improperly and is invalid or void, and therefore we believe
What relief did the bankruptcy court then enter?
I'm sorry, I did not hear you.
What relief did the bankruptcy court provide? Violating the automatic stay is contempt of court, so I would have expected a contempt remedy by the bankruptcy judge. Is that what he did?
The judge ordered them to set the judgment aside.
No,
there was no
federal
relief
judges
ordered.
Can't set state court judgments aside.
No, he ordered the party to set it aside.
No, the parties can't do that.
Okay.
Judges, state judges can do that. I want to know, what relief did he order?
There was no relief ordered other than he determined.
You know what the name for a judicial opinion without relief is?
No, sir.
It's called an advisory opinion.
Okay.
And advisory opinions are canonically ineffective.
Okay. As a result of the court's order, the Indiana trustees set the judgment aside. So the judgment has been set aside.
Who set the judgment aside?
The Indiana trustees, the underlying plaintiff in the case, in the state case.
So they moved in the state court,
there
and the state court
in the
set
state
it
court?
Aside.
That yes,
so
it has
there's
been
a judicial
aside.
Order from the state court.
I'm not sure if an order was issued or not. I didn't receive a copy
well,
of it. I just know that it was set aside.
Rather important.
Yes.
I apologize.
But you don't know. There's nothing in your brief which suggests that the state judge has set aside that order.
It's my understanding it was set aside. I was still represented by counsel
at
that time.
It was set aside. The passive conceals important things. The bankruptcy judge didn't do that and had no power to do that. The bankruptcy judge had the power to impose penalties for contempt of court, which he didn't. A state judge could set the order aside, and of course if the state judge sets the order aside, there's no Rooker-Feldman problem. But you tell me you don't know whether the state judge has set it aside.
It was my understanding, I was still represented by counsel at that time, it was my understanding that the Indiana trustees had moved to set it aside and the judgment has been set aside.
So I think you need,
need
I will ask
document.
Both sides to supplement the record with this court to let us know what is the status of that Indiana state court proceeding. If the judgment has been set aside, we need a copy of the order showing that it was set aside and the date on which that order was entered. And if it hasn't been, then we'll need a brief status report about what's happening in the Indiana litigation. And
yes.
I would like to have that filed, let's say, that shouldn't be that hard to find, within 7 business days.
Yes, Sean.
So, the other point I wanted to just explore with you briefly is that even if you can get over Rooker-Feldman, your opponents have made additional arguments saying that on the merits this was properly dismissed. It's not quite the same as a jurisdictional dismissal, of course. But they suggest that you're time barred because your pleading, even though it's looking at May 10th, 2011, is really going all the way back to when the state court judgment was entered, and there is a significant time issue there. And they also make a judicial estoppel argument.
I would like to address the rest of their arguments, if I may. First and foremost, I would suggest that those issues are not properly in front of the court. The court, orders specifically dismiss those issues as moot based on their dismissal of Rockefeller.
But they were raised in the lower court, and your opponents are raising them now as essentially an alternative ground.
Well, but the court has not had an opportunity at the local level to rule on those issues.
Why do they need to do that? Isn't the statute of limitations a legal issue?
Well, the statute of limitations, I can speak directly to that first. There may have been violations of the Act prior to the one-year limitation, and had we raised those issues, they would have been barred by a statute of limitations. The only issues in the complaint that are raised are there actions that took place within the year period prior to filing the action itself.
So your complaint, though, says the state court judgment was void shortly after the judgment was entered, and they attempted on numerous occasions and over many years to collect on the void judgment.
They have an ongoing responsibility. It doesn't just happen on that day. There is an ongoing responsibility to set that judgment or to notify the court of a judgment that's invalidly entered over the top of a Chapter 7 or a Chapter 13 bankruptcy stay. So that's an ongoing obligation on the part of the side that enters the judgment.
Now, this judgment is on a debt, right? Ultimately, long ago, there was a debt to the trustees of Indiana University. So one of the other things that has occurred to me is that the debt is the debt, whether there was a state court judgment affirming that debt or not. The debt kind of precedes the state court judgment. So I'm not sure that your ability to complain is something that you can get away from that original debt for.
I'm sorry, I'm not understanding your question.
Well,
it's been our position all along that the debt is not owed. That was the reason why we went back to challenge the debt to begin with.
Right, and there the state court judgment stands in your way. The state court judgment, unless there's a problem with it, which we'll discover, says, well, the debt is owed, and you can't do anything about that until you get over Rooker-Feldman. We're not allowed to review.
Well, I think that the FDCPA case allows for review, and if you look at a couple of the cases, specifically the Kelly case that they cite and Stefanoski, both of these suggest that any time you have an FDCPA case or claim that has something to do with doing something inappropriate in the state court, obviously, the nature of that complaint is going to have them looking at that judgment and whether there's some validity or not. I think that the bankruptcy court has some leeway in looking past that. Otherwise,
well,
you're going to say that every debt that you file...
Yeah, you're conflating several things, because the bankruptcy court, certainly the automatic stay should have been, if that was in place, that's one issue. But I don't think the FDCPA necessarily conflicts with the state court judgment. Sometimes there'll be a valid and conceded debt, but somebody's behaving in violation of the FDCPA through the methodologies they're choosing to collect on that debt. And so there's nothing inconsistent with the state court judgment and a potential FDCPA claim. I mean, there are a lot of different possibilities here, and you need to be careful not to conflate them.
Okay. But with respect to specifically in Stefanoski, because of a financial hardship, the court in the FDCPA case, the federal court, had to make a finding that the wage garnishment was inappropriately entered. So they are going back and reviewing to some extent decisions and procedures that are taking place.
Well, the federal court can review the collection activity. That's a separate question from
an
attack on the underlying judgment. But your FDCPA claim here is ultimately an attack on the underlying judgment. Your claimed statutory violation is that they pursued collections proceeding in a void judgment.
That's correct. All the complaint is an attack on the collection within the 1 year of filing
the statute. Because the judgment is void.
That's correct.
Which is an attack on the judgment.
Okay. I don't see it that way, but okay. I think they have the ongoing obligation to set that judgment aside. That is, in and of itself, the FDCPA violation, is because they had a violation of that. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Okay, you can reserve your last minute. Mr. Kuntz.
Good May it please the court, Richard Kuntz for the Koch Law Firm, defendant appellee. I'd first like to talk about waiver. I believe in the district court pointed out that plaintiff waived his Rooker-Feldman argument that the judgment of the district court and the state court judgment were not inextricably intertwined.
Well, the whole Rooker-Feldman line of cases is a jurisdictional line of cases. We either have jurisdiction to move forward or we don't. So I'm not sure that I would go the waiver route here. I really hate this inextricably intertwined notion. I think that, you know, either there's a state court judgment that he is asking for some inappropriate kind of federal court oversight over, or there isn't. And that's partly up to Congress. I mean, just to give you an example from a completely different area, there are state court judgments in criminal cases, but Congress has chosen to give habeas corpus power to the federal courts, and so that doesn't fall within the scope of the Rooker-Feldman doctrine. It's a different set of jurisdictional provisions. There is certainly the bankruptcy code, and so it can happen, whether it happened here, I'm not saying, but it certainly can happen that a state court will fail to respect the automatic stay in a bankruptcy proceeding, and the bankruptcy courts need to be able to have full authority over an estate or they can't function. So that's not quite the same thing as just, hey, I'm a state court loser and now I'm going to go over to federal court and see if I can get somebody to criticize the judgment. So I think we have to decide, you know, what are we dealing with here?
Well, Chief Judge, we're dealing with not a bankruptcy court decision, but a district court decision. And it gets very important, as Judge Easterbrook suggested earlier, the bankruptcy court has power to protect its jurisdiction over improper actions that occur before it or in relation to violation of the automatic stay. The Rooker-Feldman cases that are cited by plaintiff all arise out of the bankruptcy court.
So you think that the district court doesn't have the authority to look and see if the automatic stay was violated in a bankruptcy proceeding?
I think the district court in this case looked at Rooker-Feldman and said, I can't make a decision without determining whether the state court judgment is valid. The district court was not looking at bankruptcy court. She was looking at the validity, and she says, I can't do this.
But was she right to say that? Remember, the bankruptcy court, who knows what the bankruptcy courts are going to be next year, but the bankruptcy court right now is a division of the district court. And there is, usually in every district court, there's a standing reference to the bankruptcy court for bankruptcy proceedings. But the district court is in the picture institutionally all along. And so the question really is, when this case came up, did the district court miss a step in the proceedings by jumping right to Rooker-Feldman without asking whether the bankruptcy overlay made any difference?
I don't think the district court did miss that. And again, the bankruptcy court could have been applied to if plaintiff felt that the automatic stay was being violated in some fashion.
So is that what you think should have happened when you're there trying to collect the judgment and Mr. Richardson doesn't ever really follow through on any of his efforts to prevent you from doing so? Seems like he files all sorts of things. But what he should have done is gone back to the bankruptcy court. I'm not sure actually how he wound up filing so many bankruptcies back to back, but he should have gone back to the bankruptcy court to stop you.
I think so. He filed a Chapter 7 case, a Chapter 13 case, but at the end of the day, this case that the Court of Appeals is reviewing is the Federal District Court's decision that, based on Rooker-Feldman, she had to dismiss the case because to entertain it would have required her to essentially rule on or alter.
Did anybody ask the district judge to withdraw the reference to the bankruptcy court and then act just as if the judge were herself a bankruptcy judge?
I don't believe that was done. In terms of timing of all of these related proceedings, which goes...
And speaking of bankruptcy judges, what do you think the current status of the state court judgment is? Mr. Richardson said he thought it had been set aside by a state judge, that we didn't have any documentation. What's your understanding?
My understanding is, first of all, the argument of plaintiff on this in his brief and in before this court...
I'm not interested in his briefs. I just want to know about the state court
judgment. I'd just like to throw... It's
do you
important.
Know?
It's not nearly a... I do know. I'm going to get to that.
So but tell, no, don't get to it. Tell us okay. now.
My information is that the summary judgment was granted in favor of the trustees in the Chapter 7 adversarial proceeding on August 21st, 2013.
No, you're referring now to what the bankruptcy judge said.
Right.
I'm asking whether the state court
right. the state
has
collection,
done anything.
That was my next one. After that... the Chapter 7 case was closed on November 12, 2013, and then in the collection suit, which is the state court action, as I understand, supplementary proceedings in the Indiana State Court post-judgment, on January 28, 2014, the judgment was set aside on the trustee's motion. That is, the September 12, 2000 judgment was set aside on the motion by the trustees of the University of Indiana on August 28th, 2014,
so,
2 years after the appeal.
So what in the world then are we talking about Rooker-Feldman? If the state court has set aside the judgment, there can't be any Rooker-Feldman problem, can there?
When the district court made
the answer is yes or no. With no state court judgment anymore in effect, what conceivable Rooker-Feldman problem is there?
If the district court, which raised Rooker-Feldman sua sponte, because we didn't raise it, if you can project in the future and turn the appellate process on its head, then there wouldn't have been an appellate.
Doesn't
wouldn't have
matter.
Been
a, it's a jurisdictional doctrine, and we have to follow jurisdiction
okay.
all the way.
Then
through.
There wouldn't be a Rooker-Feldman
all right.
doctrine.
There wouldn't, and you have lots of other arguments.
Yes.
That, you know, you're not whatever. Not.
And the district court also recognized, it's not that the district court didn't consider those arguments. The district court issued two show cause orders on several matters, including Rooker-Feldman, and then she
so,
eventually...
Right, no, we remember all of that. Okay. So I still, my order from the bench stands. I would like both parties to look into this, and, you know, if you want to file an agreed statement, that's fine with me, but in 7 business days, I would like a copy of the state order either dismissing or in whatever else may have happened in the state court.
Yes, Your Honor. If I may just briefly adjust the statute of limitations, that this is a 1988 debt. There was an action on the debt in 1998. There was a judgment on the debt in 2000. The FDCPA violations that are alleged in his complaint actually go back to the collection activities in the supplemental proceedings, which commenced in 2007.
But why would it not be at least theoretically possible? Suppose your client was behaving in an exemplary fashion until 2013, and then, you know, you hired some guy named Luigi, you know, to come visit Mr. Richardson to collect the debt in some way that utterly violates FDCPA, and he said, I'm complaining about what you did in 2013. I know you guys were nice, you know, for a long time, but it seems to me it's just time-barred for
right.
the old
but
stuff.
You could do that, but that's not what was done in this case.
Well,
and
I
the district
we'll
court
see.
Recognized the attempts to plead around the one-year statute of limitation and suggested that certainly if she said in footnote 5
but
on...
Let me tell you a different version of this. The Rooker-Feldman doctrine as applied to a state court civil judgment is a lot like the doctrine of Heck against Humphrey, that while there is an outstanding state court judgment, you can't have federal litigation that's inconsistent with the state court judgment. What the Supreme Court has said about how that interacts with the statute of limitations is that the statute of limitations on the federal claim doesn't begin to run until the state court judgment is set aside, because until that moment, you can't sue in federal court. Now, why isn't that equally true of Rooker-Feldman? If you're complaining about some effort to enforce a state court judgment, you can't sue given Rooker-Feldman until the moment the state court judgment is set aside. And that appears to be in January 2014, which by analogy would lead me to think that the claim accrued in January 2014, and it's still live.
That makes sense. I mean, the plaintiff's theory was that the judgment was improper or invalid in some way prior to that time, and that therefore there was a statutory violation.
Well, maybe not. You know, maybe the answer is there isn't a violation of the federal statute as long as the state judgment is actually outstanding. Once it gets set aside, you can't try to enforce it, and the claim, any new claim, would accrue.
Right.
Maybe that's the right way to think. But it's very difficult to see how, if the analogy to Heck against Humphrey carries any water, a claim could have accrued and expired before it was even possible to sue in federal court.
That would certainly be a basis for the district court to have dismissed the case that was before it, but it also had other bases to dismiss the case that was before it, which was based on specific allegations that the plaintiff raised, and which the court considered were time-barred, and I certainly think there's a lot of support that the support was time-barred. If Your Honor,
if you could just wrap up with one final thought.
Yeah, the post-appeal proceedings, we will answer your questions on. I don't think they're relevant to what the district court did. I think the district court decision can be affirmed both based on Rooker-Feldman and statute of limitations and judicial estoppel. He did not respond to those arguments, and those are not jurisdictional, and I think they're waived.
And just to clarify, this suit was filed in 2012 and dismissed in 2012, which is apparently 2 years before the state court judgment was vacated.
Correct, and 1 year after the appeal was filed, yes. The statutory case was filed in May 2012, and yes, that timeline is correct.
So at the time the case was dismissed, there may have been a Rooker-Feldman problem.
Yes, Your Honor. That is our position. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Richardson?
Just briefly so I can clarify some facts.
Why didn't you list this FDCPA claim in your bankruptcy?
The bankruptcy was in 2000. The actions were...
Well, no, you reopened it.
Pardon?
You reopened it.
Oh,
and
when we reopened it,
the course of conduct that you're complaining about goes back many years.
When we reopened it, it was simply to reopen it because we couldn't get them to dismiss the suit. That's what I was going to address. That's what we finally went back and reopened the bankruptcy case to get relief from the bankruptcy.
After the bankruptcy judge decided not to enter a remedy, did you appeal?
It was my understanding that he did issue a remedy.
No, he did not.
So I stand corrected if that's not the case.
The bankruptcy judge said the state judgment was invalid but did not enter a remedy. And the reason the bankruptcy judge did not enter a remedy is the bankruptcy judge said any claim belonged to the trustee, not to your client. And therefore, your client was the wrong person to be making any request.
Okay.
The question is, did your client appeal from that order?
No, sir.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks to both sides. We'll take the case under advisement.